Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, John McCain says the ban on oil drilling off the U.S. coast should be lifted to increase oil production and lower prices. Drilling opponents say the drilling won't lower prices and will endanger environments. Who's right? Mainstream reporting is little help, rarely offering more than to say that the story is about a trade-off between fuel costs and environmental costs. We'll talk to Tyson Slocum, the director of Public Citizens Energy Program, about the price of oil. Also on the show, the case Fox versus FCC that the Supreme Court will hear next fall has so far received next to no media attention. That may change as more people come to realize that the impact of the ruling could stretch far beyond Fox to the question of whether broadcasters should have any public interest obligations whatsoever. We'll hear from author and FCC expert Matthew Lazar about what's potentially at stake in this case. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Given that George W. Bush's approval rating is now 29%, it's not surprising that Republican presidential candidate John McCain would claim that his ideas are a lot different from Bush's, or that his opponent, Barack Obama, would say that McCain and Bush are quite similar. Voters look to the media to help them sort through such conflicting claims, and the media generally let the voters down, preferring to declare there's truth on both sides, even when the truth is mostly on one side. That's what the New York Times did with its front page June 17th piece headlined, "Is McCain like Bush? It depends on the issue." While reporter Elizabeth Boumiller did allow that McCain and Bush are close on some big-ticket issues, Iraq, the economy, health care, she also reported that, quote, "On the environment, American diplomacy, and nuclear proliferation, Mr. McCain has strikingly different views from Mr. Bush," close quote. So McCain and Obama are both right, which is the safest thing a journalist can say. Trouble is, when you look at the evidence the paper presented, those differences really aren't so striking. Take diplomacy. An accompanying chart actually lists diplomacy with Iran and Syria as an area where Bush and McCain mostly agree. Boumiller's evidence for disagreement is a quote in which McCain endorses strong alliances, as if Bush speaks out against strong alliances. On nuclear proliferation, McCain is said to differ because he prefers the Bush administration's earlier, more hardline position towards Korea. And on the environment, McCain distinguishes himself from Bush with a mixed record, which, as the paper notes, includes agreeing with Bush on offshore drilling, the Kyoto Agreement, and nuclear power. The Times, in short, strained to find ways to avoid saying the obvious. McCain is much more like Bush than he is different.
While some media strain to find distinctions where they don't exist between John McCain and George W. Bush, efforts to explain the actually different positions held by McCain and Barack Obama on economic issues like taxes often wind up a corporate media muddle. Typically unhelpful was NPR's Mara Liasson, who said on Fox News Sunday, June 15th, that Obama was pushing, quote, "old Democratic arguments. It's pretty populist, you know, tax the rich." And on McCain's side, much more standard boilerplate Republican talk about taxes, close quote. Instead of adding substance to such sloppy conventional wisdom, outlets more often simply add spin, as when the Los Angeles Times stated in a June 15th piece, quote, "A risk for Obama is that some of his policies, such as his call for raising taxes on the wealthy while cutting them for the middle class, will be rejected by swing voters wary of redistributing wealth," close quote. Seems clear the paper doesn't think it's redistributing wealth when the money goes upward. And anyway, polls actually have long showed that majorities of people don't have a problem with raising taxes on the wealthy. New York Times business columnist David Leonhardt did note on June 18th that the press corps have so far done a poor job of explaining the candidates' plans, adding his view that the unknowns about the McCain agenda are simply on a different scale. Now, if his paper and others would work to fill in those unknowns, voters would be better served.
In a recent column on Huffington Post, co-founder of Just Foreign Policy, Mark Weisbrot, noted that U.S. media were caught by surprise in early June when Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez stated that the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the guerrilla army known as the FARC, should lay down their arms. As Weisbrot wrote, quote, Chavez's announcement should not have come as a surprise because he said the same thing before, close quote. Indeed, in January, Chavez denounced the FARC's policy of kidnapping, calling on the group to release all its hostages and declaring, I do not agree with the armed struggle. That hasn't stopped U.S. journalists from portraying Chavez as a staunch supporter of the FARC, as Time magazine put it on June 9th. Likewise, an Associated Press story on June 10th falsely reported that Chavez had been, quote, urging world leaders to back the FARC's armed struggle, close quote. Weisbrot was able to get the AP to issue a correction over the false quote. But it will take more than Weisbrot's prodding to get many journalists to get their facts straight on the Venezuelan president. Because of their reliance on U.S. sources and their aversion to independent reporting, many have spent years getting the story wrong.
In the wake of Tim Russert's sudden death, journalists have praised the late NBC Meet the Press host as a particularly tough interviewer who pressed Vice President Dick Cheney about White House claims in the lead-up to the Iraq War. Those with a quite different recollection of Russert's role in grilling Cheney include Cheney's own press aide. Testifying in the perjury trial of former Cheney Chief of Staff Scooter Libby, Cheney aide Kathy Martin recalled that when the Bush administration had to respond to charges that it had manipulated pre-Iraq war intelligence, quote, I suggested we put the vice president on Meet the Press, which was a tactic we often used. It's our best format, close quote. Indeed, on the morning that the New York Times published a front-page article falsely touting the now-famous aluminum tubes as components of an alleged Iraqi nuclear weapons program, Cheney was put on Meet the Press, where Russert pursued open-ended questions that seemed to invite spin from the vice president on Iraqi nuclear weapons. The fact that the program that many journalists are now holding up as a model of tough questioning on Iraq war intelligence is the same program the White House saw as their best format for advancing spin about Iraq, well, you could hardly ask for a more telling indictment of U.S. journalistic culture.
And finally, the most recent column on talk radio host Michael Reagan's website takes John McCain to task for mumbling. Explains Reagan, quote, you can't make a point if you can't articulate it in the strongest and clearest way possible, close quote. Reagan might argue he was doing just that on his June 10th show, in which the conservative syndicated host called for a man's murder. Reagan, the son of Ronald Reagan, had learned about people sending letters and DVDs to troops in Iraq, advancing the unsupported theory that the U.S. government aided in the execution of the September 11th attacks. Declared Reagan to his 5 million or so listeners, quote, you shoot them. You call them traitors. That's what they are, and you shoot them dead. I'll pay for the bullets, close quote. Still more troubling, Reagan singled out one man by name, saying, quote, how about you take Mark Dice out and put him in the middle of a firing range? Tie him to a post. Don't blindfold him. Let it rip and have some fun with Mark Dice, close quote. Talk radio is full of obnoxious talk, but it shouldn't need saying that the naming of a person on air and calling for his murder crosses a dangerous line. But it's one Reagan's crossed before. He once said Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean should be arrested and hung for treason or put in a hole until the end of the Iraq War. And having heard that a Middle Eastern woman had named her baby Hezbollah, he declared that the child too should be killed and added, quote, what's wrong with killing the mothers and the babies, close quote. Reagan, who sells a DVD called Twice Adopted, Loved by a President, Redeemed by God, subsequently apologized to Dice. But the question remains how syndicators and programmers can justify murderous rants as a worthwhile use of the public's airwaves.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
GOP presidential candidate John McCain has joined George Bush in calling for lifting the ban on new oil drilling in U.S. coastal waters. The two say increased U.S. production of oil will increase supply and lower the price at the pump for American consumers. The story is being presented as a cost-benefit trade-off between the environment and economically vital energy prices. But is it? What would be the actual effect on gas prices if the U.S. were to increase production by, say, 800,000 to 1 million barrels per day? today. It's hard to tell because most mainstream American news outlets fail to do the reporting that would clarify the issue. Joining us to explain some of the economics is Tyson Slocum, the director of Public Citizens Energy Program. Tyson Slocum, welcome back to Counterspin.
It's great to be here.
Well, before we get to the economics of all this, I'd like to begin by asking you the central media question. Have you seen much reporting explaining the actual benefits that would accrue to consumers if the U.S. were to increase production?
Unfortunately, no. Most of the reporting has fallen along the typical lines of he said, she said, quoting different political operatives for campaigns or party officials making claims about whether or not drilling would lower prices or not. But very little independent analysis, very little analysis from parties that do not have a financial stake in the outcome. So I don't think the media has really served the public well on this debate over whether we should drill for more oil or not.
Well, let's talk about the economics that are largely missing in U.S. reporting. There are answers that are apprehensible here. What actual benefits in price reduction would consumers see if U.S. gas production were increased?
Very little to none. I mean, the issue here is a question of scale. Oil is a globally priced commodity, and we see an example of that with the recent decrease in U.S. gasoline demand. Gasoline demand has decreased by 1%. From a year ago, which is significant given the size of the U.S. economy. Now, from a classical economic perspective, when demand goes down, as it has in the United States, prices should go down. But that hasn't been the issue. Prices instead have gone up, even though consumers have been cutting back and using less gasoline. That's because demand hasn't been going down in other countries like China and India. So fast forward to, let's say we want to increase oil production offshore in the United States, which is the proposal put forward by Senator McCain and President Bush. Because the increase in prospective production off the shore of the United States would be so minimal compared to global production and global demand. I mean, every day we use about 87 million barrels of oil a day. And assuming
that's worldwide?
That's worldwide. In the United States, we use about 21 million barrels of oil a day. So assuming that in a decade, we would increase production by 500,000 to a million barrels of oil a day, because it would take a decade, assuming that we were to open up these offshore areas for new drilling today, it would take about 10 years to develop them. That is not going to be a drop in the bucket. And so as a result, it really would not have a significant effect on lowering prices. The United States does not have the oil reserves that Saudi Arabia does. We've got less than 3% of the world's oil under our shores and under our land. That just is not enough to make a difference in the global supply-demand picture. And it's important to note that there are Republican governors, such as Schwarzenegger, and up until recently, Florida's Governor Crist, you know, have been against increasing drilling for the fear that all it takes is one spill to spoil beaches and affect tourism and other quality of life issues. So I don't think that all of the lucrative areas that folks want to tap into would ever be tapped into, because environmental risks to new drilling are very real. I think that a more coherent energy policy would focus more on demand. Any way you look at the U.S. energy crisis, it is a crisis of demand. We use energy among the least efficiently of our competitors, particularly in Europe and Japan. And the government ought to be prioritizing providing incentives to help families make better environmental and economic decisions. There's a lot of folks out there that would like to do more to cut back on their energy usage, but they can't afford to buy, you know, super fuel-efficient hybrid vehicles, or they can't afford to install solar panels on the roof or make environmentally friendly renovations to their home or buy that new energy-efficient appliance. All of those investments take a lot of money, and right now family budgets are stretched thin. So rather than focusing on this debate on whether drilling our way to lower prices will be effective, I think that we ought to focus on the facts. And the facts are the best way to address an energy crisis like ours is to put more resources in the hands of consumers to help them use energy more wisely. And I think that's the energy policy that hasn't been pursued, particularly by this administration. Remember, Vice President Dick Cheney famously said very early on in the Bush administration in 2001 that while conservation is a fine personal virtue, it's no basis for national energy policy. And as we have painfully learned, Vice President Dick Cheney couldn't be more wrong. Conservation is the hallmark of an effective energy policy, especially when we only have 3% of the world's oil resources, but use 25% of the world's oil every day.
Well, I'd like to address one media myth that you hear all the time. I recently heard Bill O'Reilly on Fox saying that U.S. production would specifically benefit the U.S. As you mentioned earlier, it's a global oil market. Isn't oil fungible? So it wouldn't really specifically benefit the U.S.
That's right. I mean, when you increase production or decrease production or decrease demand, you have to take into account what's going on all over the world. You know, like I said earlier, U.S. gasoline consumption is actually down 1%, which is a very significant number given our population and economic growth over that time period. But yet, because other countries like China and India and elsewhere are using more oil, the price of oil has gone up, even in the United States where we use less. And so it doesn't matter as much what we do here in the United States as long as other countries are bucking that trend, which is why it's so important when you talk about energy policy reforms to get as much resources in the hands of consumers to help them avoid paying these high prices, get them access to alternatives, get them access to mass transit, allow them to generate their own energy from renewable resources. Because our energy problem is not just a problem of our addiction to oil, but our addiction to centralized energy production that is controlled increasingly by a very small number of energy corporations. Distributing energy production among individual households and allowing individual households to become far more efficient at the way they use energy would be the kind of revolution that America desperately needs, not only to break our oil habit, but to deal effectively with climate change and to put more money in the hands of American consumers.
We've been speaking with Tyson Slocum, the director of Public Citizens Energy Project. Tyson Slocum, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
It was my pleasure.
The Supreme Court will hear the case Fox versus FCC next fall, and media policy watchers are keeping a close eye. But it isn't the immediate substance of the case that's raising concern. That has to do with the FCC's new policy calling for punishments for stations that air so-called fleeting expletives. The potentially much more significant thing is a sort of side comment from the Second Circuit, whose decision the Supreme Court will be reviewing, a comment that throws into question the whole matter of any public interest obligations for broadcasters. Here to explain what's potentially at stake is Matthew Lazar. Matthew Lazar writes about the FCC and media policy for the Ars Technica News and Information Service. He's a lecturer of telecommunications history at UC Santa Cruz and author of several books, including Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War. He joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome to Counterspin, Matthew Lazar.
Thanks for having me.
So what did the lower court say in Fox versus FCC, and what about it has people concerned?
Well, in the course of their decision to strike down the FCC's new policy on punishing broadcasters for fleeting potty talk, or whatever it is you want to call it, they made this kind of side comment that in terms of regulating broadcasting, and I quote, technological advances may obviate the constitutional legitimacy of the FCC's robust oversight. And for about six public interest groups, the Benton Foundation, the American Academy of Pediatrics, Children Now, and a couple of others, this was a kind of an alarm signal. What it said was that the Second Court is sort of buying into what the broadcasters have been saying for a long time, which is that because we live in this wonderful world, which is the internet, there is no more spectrum scarcity. The premise of media regulation, the foundation of media regulation since the late 1960s, the idea that the spectrum is scarce and therefore there needs to be oversight because we can't all share the spectrum equally, that's a really important part. And what these groups are afraid of is that this premise will be struck down by the Supreme Court, which has a bunch of people in it who, as you know, are perfectly happy to strike down such a premise, and that that important foundation of FCC public interest oversight will be gone.
Well, let's talk about the relevant history here, because there's the ruling that many people might not know about, but for students of journalism, it's significant, the Red Lion ruling. Can you tell us what the story is there?
Well, you know, after Lyndon Johnson won re-election to the White House in 1964, the forces which had supported Barry Goldwater were bitter, and they took a little of their bitterness out on a guy named Fred Cook, who wrote a polemic about Johnson's opponent, Barry Goldwater. The book was titled Goldwater, Extremist on the Right. And at a radio station owned by the Red Lion Company in Pennsylvania, they had a show called Christian Crusade, and the broadcaster of that show accused Cook of being a communist collaborator and having been fired from a newspaper for writing a bunch of false stories. And Cook found out about this, and he found out that that little show was broadcast on about 400 radio stations across the United States. And he wrote them all little letters saying that basically he had this little tape which he'd like to send them. And he thought that given that there was this thing called the Fairness Doctrine back then, enforced by the FCC, that he had the right to respond to what was essentially an attack on his credibility and his personhood. And this Red Lion radio station, WGCB, sent him back a little note saying if he wanted to pay for it, he could do it, but he wouldn't get any free time. Mm-hmm. And so the FCC became very involved in this case, and it basically sided with Cook, and it said that he had the right to respond to these assertions. And the case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court issued a very important decision called Red Lion Broadcasting versus the Federal Communications Commission. And what Justice Byron Wright declared was that the scarcity of radio frequencies, it kind of complicates the First Amendment's applicability in this issue. Most people can't buy or run radio stations. Today, there's about 13,500 radio stations and 300 million people. So not everybody can have a radio station. So the First Amendment, to the extent that it applies to this issue, it doesn't apply, as the Red Lion Company said, to its right to just broadcast whatever it wanted. Judge Byron White said it applies to all of us, and it basically says that we all have the First Amendment right to be on the publicly owned airwaves. I'll read you the relevant sentence here is in this decision is, it is the right of the viewers and the listeners, not the right of the broadcasters, which is paramount. It is the purpose of the First Amendment to preserve an uninhibited marketplace of ideas in which truth will ultimately prevail, rather than to countenance monopolization of that market, whether it be by the government itself or a private licensee. And the Red Lion decision is basically the foundation of public interest regulation. It's basically the basis of the Federal Communications Commission's right to regulate on the airwaves in the public interest. Since we can't all have access to these radio and television stations, we at least should have access to rules to make sure that these radio and television stations serve all of us in various ways.
Well, of course, what's been interesting is that the Red Lion decision and that founding idea has been under attack, not just from broadcasters and broadcasting and cable, which is one of the few outlets to report on the relevance of this new ruling to Red Lion, called it shopworn and ludicrous, the whole scarcity argument. But it has also been the FCC itself, it seems, in recent years that has been critical of that. Former Commissioner Michael Powell had his infamous story about waiting to be visited by the angel of the public interest, someone who would explain to him what it even meant to enforce public interest standards in broadcasting, and she never came. Michael Powell is now out arguing against Red Lion as we speak.
Prior to Michael Powell, there was, of course, Mark Fowler, who was Ronald Reagan's FCC commissioner, who famously said that it was time to get out of the public interest business. He famously said television is just an appliance. It's just a toaster with pictures.
So let me ask you then, finally, I mean, we complain that the FCC has basically been giving industry the regulations they want for some time now, but can we speculate, and the concern that people have here about eliminating the FCC's role here, can we speculate what the landscape might look like with no FCC?
Well, the big thing that people are afraid of, that these public interest groups are afraid of at this moment is whether or not this would have an impact on the enforcement of the Children's Television Act. Children's Television Act, passed in 1990, is a very important law which limits the number of commercials that can be shown on children's television, requires broadcasters to broadcast a certain amount of children's educational television. And this is a very important issue for all of us because, as you know, broadcasters try to sell a lot of garbage to children, and that's one of the reasons why we're having a diabetes, obesity epidemic among children in the United States today. So what these six public interest groups don't want is for the FCC, as a result of a Supreme Court decision, to just basically throw up their hands and say, well, you know, it's clear what the Supreme Court has said, that we don't really have the authority anymore to even enforce minimal public interest requirements like making sure that television doesn't sell our children too much garbage. That's really what's the most important thing at stake for these six public interest groups that filed their amicus curiae brief with the Supreme Court last month.
We've been speaking with Matthew Lazar. You can find his work on FCC and media policy issues online at arstechnica.com. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.